Hi, everyone. It's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
This is Crime House.
By 1984, the dream of Rajneeshpuram was already rotting from the inside. The woman running the place had a network of spies, a medical clinic that doubled as a weapon, and one simple rule: loyalty or else. An ultimatum that would end up sending hundreds of people to the hospital. Every crime tells a story about the people involved, the system that tried to stop it, and the nation that couldn't look away. Some cases are so shocking, so deeply woven into who we are, that decades later, we're still asking, how did this happen? I'm Katie Ring, and this is America's Most Infamous Crimes. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'll take you deep into cases that have a lasting imprint on society and still haunt us today. Crime House exists because of listeners like you. Want even more? Join Crime House Plus and get all three parts of each week's America's Most Infamous Crime Stories dropped at once every Monday and ad-free. You'll also get the rest of the Crime House lineup ad-free and early, and exclusive bonus episodes. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you listen on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of the America's Most Infamous Crime Show page. This is the second of our three-episode series on the cult known as the Rajneesh Movement. Today, I'm taking you behind the gates to the spies, the drugging, and the homemade germ lab that turned a spiritual community into a crime scene.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Just a few years after setting up in the Oregon desert, Bhagwan Sri Ranish's followers built an entire city and took over another town at the ballot box. But the real story of Rajneeshpuram was never about the people outside the gates. It was about what happened to the people inside. And by 1984, a lot of them were starting to realize the same thing. Getting into Rajneeshpuram was easy. Getting out was a different story. Because Ma Anand Sheela didn't just run the commune, she controlled it. And the key to Sheila's power was simple. She controlled access to Rajneesh himself. With the guru silent and tucked away in his compound, almost no one could reach him directly anymore. If you wanted to communicate with him, it went through Sheila. If you wanted to communicate with the community, that went through Sheila too. Which meant she could shape what he heard about the outside world and shape what the world heard from him. It's hard to overstate how much leverage that gave her. When you're the only one with access to the spiritual guru, people will do almost anything to stay on your good side. If you criticized her or asked too many questions, you were labeled negative, and being negative had consequences. You'd get pulled off whatever work you were doing and reassigned to the worst jobs on the ranch. Other members would be told to stop talking to you. In a community built entirely on belonging, Sheila's favorite weapon was making you feel completely alone. If you had a problem with how things were run, the problem was your ego, your attachment, your failure to surrender, so people learned to keep their doubts to themselves. It's a typical cult manipulation tactic. You don't need to silence critics if you can convince them that speaking up is a sign they're spiritually broken. And remember, all of this was happening behind a beautiful facade. From the outside, and even from the inside, if you weren't paying close attention, Rajneeshpuram still looked like paradise. People in flowing red robes, dancing at sunset, hugging strangers, building a city in the desert with their bare hands. The joy was genuine for a lot of people, which is exactly what made the control so hard to see, For most followers, the dream and the trap were the same place, and they couldn't tell where one ended and the other began. But the petty stuff was just the surface, because Sheila had something far more powerful than gossip and bad job assignments. She had a doctor. Her name was Ma Anand Pooja, an American nurse who'd trained in California before she discovered Rajneesh's teachings in India. Her rise inside the movement was almost suspiciously fast. Within a year of arriving, she was running the entire Rajneesh Medical Corporation. And she was one of the three women at the very top of Sheila's inner circle, who some followers called the Big Moms. That was the real power structure of Rajneeshpuram, a small handful of women, led by Sheila, who controlled the money, the security, the medicine. And if you crossed any of them, the medicine is where it would catch up with you. When Sheila wanted to get rid of someone, the clinic was where it happened. In one case, she ordered 11 people who'd fallen out of favor to get their blood tested for AIDS. This was 1984, at the absolute height of the AIDS pandemic, when an HIV diagnosis was treated like a death sentence and a reason to keep your distance. And when Pooja ran the test, she faked it so all 11 came back positive. All those followers were pushed out of Rajneeshpuram, supposedly to protect everyone else from infection. Nobody questioned it, and why would they? Who is going to argue with a doctor during an epidemic? That was the dark genius of using the clinic. All Sheila had to do to get rid of her critics was point at a medical chart. And if people couldn't be scared into leaving, the clinic could keep them from leaving at all. When three high-ranking members started quietly talking about walking away, Pooja told them they were overworked and needed some rest, with the help of heavy sedatives that left them groggy and bedridden for weeks, not exactly in a condition to pack a bag, let alone make it to the front gate. Another woman was given repeated doses of Quaaludes while she was being treated at the clinic, until she was genuinely addicted. After that, leaving wasn't exactly an option for her. But the worst of it was reserved for a whistleblower. One follower had pieced together what was really going on, and she tried to do the brave thing. She wrote a letter directly to Rajneesh himself, hoping to warn him about what Sheila was doing in his name. She never got the chance. Sheila was reading his mail, and she intercepted the letter before it ever reached him. Shortly after, that same woman came down with a mysterious illness. She was taken to Pooja's clinic where, according to accounts from former members, doctors performed a hysterectomy on her, removing her uterus in a surgery she'd never agreed to. Afterward, Pooja put her on medication that left her mentally and emotionally unstable for years to come. By this point, Sheila had eyes and ears everywhere. When investigators eventually got inside Rajneeshpuram, they'd discover one of the most extensive bugging operations they'd ever seen. Wiretaps on the phones, hidden microphones in private rooms, even in Rajneesh's own residence. A casual complaint to a friend over dinner could make its way back to Sheila by morning. Nothing happened in Rajneeshpuram that she didn't eventually know about. So picture where the believers actually stood. They'd sold their houses, quit their careers, and handed their life savings to the movement. Their entire world, their friends, their home, their sense of purpose, in many cases their marriages, was now inside those gates. Plenty of them had burned every bridge to their old lives on the way in, because that was supposed to be the point. You were leaving the empty, materialistic world behind for good. So there was no easy back home to return to. And the woman in charge had made it crystal clear that crossing her could cost you your reputation, your freedom, or even your body. They hadn't joined a commune. They'd walked into a trap, and most of them didn't realize it until the door had already shut behind them.
Hi, listeners. It's Vanessa Richardson. On a special four-episode Conspiracy Theories, Cults, and Crime series, I'm taking you to four kinds of dream getaways that went from paradise to deadly. A woman vanishes while snorkeling off Aruba, two backpackers murdered on a moonlit beach in Thailand, an NBA champion who disappears off his own catamaran in the South Pacific. These were supposed to be the trips of a lifetime. Listen to our special Deadly Destinations series every Sunday on Conspiracy Theories, Cults, and Crimes, Or if you don't want to wait, all four episodes are available right now, ad-free, on Crime House Plus. To join Crime House Plus, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at crimehouseplus.com.
While Sheila was tightening her grip on the inside, the war with the outside world was heating up fast, and it was being fought on a lot of fronts at once. The neighbors were suing, the state attorney general was in court trying to dissolve the city, and the press, both in Oregon and nationally, had turned Rajneeshpuram into a running story. Every month seemed to bring a new confrontation, and Sheila met all of them the same way, by escalating. By early 1983, the people of Oregon had turned on the Rajneeshis, and one of the loudest battlegrounds was a town called Madras, about 50 miles from the ranch. Every afternoon, Rajneesh would be driven there in one of his Rolls Royces, stop at a gas station for a drink, and then turn right back around. Nobody's ever fully explained why. Maybe it was just an excuse for him to get out, or maybe it was a way to put the movement's presence in everyone's face. Either way, once the locals figured out his routine, they started to line the streets to heckle him as he rolled past. Sheila wasn't about to let that slide, so she started bussing in her own followers to act as counter-protesters. For months, the two sides faced off on the streets of Madras. Rajneeshis on one side, furious locals on the other, until the police were genuinely worried a riot would break out. It got bad enough that the county district attorney finally stepped in and persuaded Rajneesh to knock off his little excursions. But Sheila wasn't backing down, and the bigger and bolder the community got, the more the outside world braced for something terrible. Then came the election that changed everything. Rajneeshpuram had grown into a city with thousands of people, but Sheila wanted it to get much bigger. And to do that, it needed building permits. To stop them, county and state officials kept denying the applications and tying the commune up in land use fights. The Oregon Attorney General was even in court arguing the whole city shouldn't legally exist. From Sheila's perspective, there was one obvious way out of it all: to take control of the county and approve the permits herself. The plan had already worked once, when the movement took over the town of Antelope, and in November of 1984, three seats on the Wasco County governing body were up for election, and those seats controlled exactly the things standing in her way. Permits, land use, investigations. If the Rajneeshis could put their own people in those chairs, every obstacle would simply vanish. There was just one problem: the math. Rajneesh's followers made up less than 10% of Wasco County's population. There was no honest way they were going to win a countywide vote, so Sheila came up with a plan to manufacture the votes she didn't have. She called it Share a Home. On paper, it sounded almost noble. In the late summer of 1984, the Rajneeshis announced they were going to help solve America's homelessness crisis. They sent followers fanning out into big cities, Portland, Los Angeles, New York, and more, to find people living on the streets and offer them a deal: a free bus ticket to Oregon, and a fresh start at Rajneeshpuram. They'd get free food, free housing, and guaranteed work. When the first buses rolled in, the new arrivals were welcomed with music and celebration like long-lost family. Over a matter of weeks, the Rajneeshis bussed in thousands of unhoused people from around the country. By some estimates, as many as several thousand poured into the ranch. But this was never really about charity. It was about bodies, specifically bodies that could be registered to vote in Wasco County before November. And the program turned into a disaster almost immediately. A lot of the people brought in were dealing with serious mental illness, addiction, or had criminal histories, and the commune had no real plan to care for them. They weren't suited to the grueling 16-hour farm labor everyone else did, and the peace force suddenly had its hands full, breaking up fights and disturbances. And in some cases, the cold solution to keep these new residents in line was to spike their beer with tranquilizers to keep them docile. People who had been promised a new life were now being drugged to keep them quiet so they could be counted as votes. And the cruelest part was still to come. Once these new arrivals had served their purpose, Sheila would have them sent right back out and dumped into surrounding towns, abandoned with nothing. To everyone watching from the outside, Share a Home confirmed every fear they already had. Here was a group that had taken over a town, armed itself to the teeth and was now importing busloads of strangers from across the country in what looked like a naked attempt to seize an election. County officials saw exactly what was happening, and they moved fast. They started challenging the flood of new voter registrations in court, arguing the whole thing was a sham. Election officials announced that the new arrivals would have to appear in person and prove they actually intended to live in the county before they'd be added to the rolls. The Rajneeshis fired back that their new residents were American citizens with every right to vote wherever they lived. And while that legal fight dragged on, Sheila had no guarantee it would break her way. The courts might throw out every last one of those registrations and leave her right back where she started. So she started thinking about insurance, a way to win no matter what a judge decided, no matter how many of her imported voters got struck from the rolls. If she couldn't add enough of her own people to the count, maybe she could just make sure the other side never made it to the polls at all. Here was a situation Sheila was staring at in the summer of 1984. Even with thousands of share-a-home voters, there were still tens of thousands of people in Wasco County who despised the Rajneeshis and would absolutely turn out to vote against them. To win, Sheila didn't just need more votes. She needed fewer of theirs. And she had just the person to figure out how to do that. Because her medical director, Ma Anand Pooja, wasn't just useful for controlling her followers. She was genuinely fascinated by poisons, germs, and disease. And in 1984, Pooja quietly started building a bioweapons program. Pooja simply ordered her germs over the counter, buying salmonella bacteria samples from a medical supply company up in Seattle, perfectly legally, and then growing her own cultures in a lab at the ranch. And before turning the germs on people, she tested her poisons on mice to see how sick they got. That legal, low-tech quality is exactly what would make this attack so hard to catch. Salmonella is everywhere. It turns up in undercooked chicken and mishandled food all the time. A sudden outbreak at a few restaurants wouldn't immediately scream bioterrorism. It would look like sloppy food handling. If there's any silver lining from this plot, it's that they didn't choose something much more dangerous, because investigators would later learn that Pooja and Sheila had shopped around for something even deadlier at first. They looked into the bacteria behind typhoid fever, a disease that kills. They thought about tularemia, which is so dangerous it had actually been studied as a battlefield weapon by national militaries. And most disturbing of all, there was evidence they'd explored getting their hands on HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. But in the end, they chose salmonella, which would make people violently ill, but it usually wouldn't kill them. And for Sheila's purposes, that was exactly the point. She didn't necessarily want a body count. She wanted a county full of people too sick to make it to the ballot box. But a plan like this needs to be tested. So in the late summer of 1984, the Rajneeshis ran their first live experiments on real human beings. On August 29th, two county officials drove out to Rajneeshpuram for a meeting. The relationship was already bad. County inspectors had been blocked from the ranch before, and on at least one earlier visit, officials had come back to their car to find a tire slashed. But this time, the Rajneeshis played the gracious host. While the visitors were there, they were offered glasses of water. What they didn't know was that the water had been dosed with Pooja's salmonella. Both men got sick. One of them, a county judge named William Hulse, ended up in the hospital, seriously ill. By some accounts, he came close to dying. The test had worked, exactly the way Pooja had designed it to. So the Rajneeshis pushed it even further. They fanned out around Wasco County and tried spreading the salmonella other ways, like smearing it on fresh produce in the grocery stores or wiping it onto doorknobs and even urinal handles at the county courthouse. But those attempts mostly fizzled. A doorknob doesn't reliably make a whole town sick, and produce gets washed. They needed a delivery method that would hit a lot of people at once and put the germ into something people would actually swallow without a second thought. And that's when they landed on the salad bar. In its own horrible way, it was the perfect delivery system. A salad bar is left sitting out in the open that lots of strangers touch and serve themselves, and nobody cooks afterwards. So the heat of the kitchen would never get the chance to kill the bacteria. If you wanted to make a large number of people sick without ever being noticed, you couldn't design a better target. But here's what makes this even darker. The salad bars weren't even meant to be the main event. They were just practice. Because Sheila's real plan, the truly nightmarish one, was bigger. She wanted to poison the drinking water supply of the Dalles in the days right before the election, the largest town in Wasco County and home to most of its voters. The plan was to take out the entire town in one stroke, tens of thousands of people sick at the same time. But poisoning a city's water isn't easy, and before Sheila bet everything on it, she wanted proof the salmonella would actually work the way she needed it to. So the salad bars became the trial run. And in September of 1984, small groups of Rajneeshis started making the 100-mile drive north to the Dalles. They left their distinctive red uniforms at home. Dressed in ordinary, everyday colors, they looked like anyone else running errands on a weekday afternoon. But tucked in their bags, they carried small Ziploc pouches filled with a light brown liquid, the salmonella cultured back at Pooch's lab and mixed into a slurry. They called it salsa. Over the course of several visits across September and into October, small teams of Rajneeshis worked their way through the town, hitting target after target. Their method was simple and almost impossible to catch in the act. Walk in, fix a plate like any other customer, and discreetly tip the contents of the pouch into the salad dressing or dribble it over the food. Then they'd pay, leave, and move on to the next place. One by one, they walked into 10 different restaurants around the Dalles. Pizza places, a steakhouse, the kind of ordinary spots where families ate after church. And when no one was looking, they started to pour. The largest bioterror attack in American history had just begun. At the end of each episode, I'd like to take a moment to answer any questions you may have about the case and share my thoughts. So make sure to comment below.
The medical clinic stuff is what really got to me. How does a trained nurse, someone whose whole job is to help people, end up doing this?
Participating in a scheme like this is definitely the ultimate betrayal of the oath healthcare professionals take. That's something uniquely violating about it because medicine runs entirely on trust. When you're sick, you're vulnerable, and you hand yourself over to a caregiver because you assume they're on your side. Pooja took that trust and turned it into a weapon. The fake AIDS tests, the forced sedation, the hysterectomy, every one of those is a betrayal of the single most basic promise a medical professional makes. And what makes it work as a control tactic is exactly that trust. Nobody at Rajneeshpuram is going to second-guess the doctor. If Pooja says you're sick, you're sick. If Pooja says you need rest, you take the pills. And since it was a small community, there weren't many other doctors to check her. She had a kind of authority that even Sheila couldn't fake because it came with a stethoscope. I think that's one of the lessons here. The most dangerous person in a place like this isn't always the one giving the speeches. Sometimes it's the quiet one holding the clipboard.
Why AIDS specifically? Of all the things to fake, why pick that?
The first cases of HIV and AIDS in the U.S. were reported in 1981. Doctors had no idea what it was at first, but 40% of people who had reported symptoms died. They eventually identified that it was sexually transmitted, but there were so many unanswered questions, and no one knew exactly what it was. Luckily, with advancements in medicine, HIV patients can live long lives, but back then it felt like a death sentence. With all these unknown factors and the high death rate, the public reaction was pure panic. People lost jobs, lost housing, and were shunned over a diagnosis. So if you want to remove someone from a community and have nobody push back, an AIDS diagnosis is almost the perfect tool. It comes preloaded with fear and a built-in justification. We're not exiling you, we're protecting everyone else. It reframes cruelty as public health. And in a community rooted in sexual freedom and exploration, a deadly sexually transmitted virus would obviously be a problem. These followers thought of themselves as loving, open, accepting people. Sheila knew they'd never knowingly throw someone out for being inconvenient, but for safety, for the good of the world, they'd do it without blinking. That's manipulation at a very high level.
Let's talk about Share a Home. Was there ever a sincere charitable impulse there, or was it cynical from the very first second?
I wish it was, but the facts make that almost impossible. I want to think that they were just naive and thought their teachings and way of life could transform these people. But Sheila is a meticulous planner. If the intent was to help these people, the resources and support were not there. Again, I think some of it may have been belief that they could change them. And in some ways, they actually did. The biggest thing for me that exposes her intentions the most was that after a man attacked her, she started putting sedatives in the nightly beers they would give the homeless. You don't intentionally drug someone without their knowledge if you're trying to help them. So in my mind, helping was never the point. The point was warm bodies that could be registered to vote by November. And you can see the cynicism most clearly in how it ended, which we'll get into next episode, once it was obvious those folks couldn't vote the way Sheila needed. A lot of them got dumped in nearby towns and abandoned. You don't treat people that way if you ever saw them as people. You treat them that way if you saw them as ballots. Taking the most vulnerable people in the country, dangling a fresh start, and using them as electoral cattle, that might be the coldest thing in this entire story. And there's a lot of competition.
You mentioned they look at typhoid, tularemia, even HIV. How close did this come to mass murder?
To be honest, they came closer than most people realize. We tell this story as a salad bar cult, almost like a dark comedy because nobody died. But that outcome was a choice, not luck. Pooja was weighing agents that kill. Typhoid fever, a battlefield bacteria, the AIDS virus. If Sheila had decided she wanted a body count instead of a sick day, the people of the Dalles would not have stood a chance. So I think two things are true at once. It's genuinely a small mercy that they picked something non-lethal. And two, the only reason it was non-lethal is that a woman calmly sat in a lab and decided how sick was sick enough. The fact that they were actually contemplating starting pandemics or epidemics is monstrous in and of itself. I think the only reason they didn't was fear that it could affect some of their community members and come back to them.
It's easy to focus on Sheila and Pooja, but what about the 1,000 ordinary followers? Were they victims here or were they part of it?
I think the honest answer is that most of them were victims, and that's what makes this so sad. The vast majority of the people at Rajneeshpuram had no idea any of this was happening. They were the ones clearing fields and pouring concrete and genuinely believing they were building something beautiful. The poisonings, the lab, the wiretaps, that was a tiny inner circle. The big moms and a handful of trusted lieutenants. Most followers found out the same way the rest of the world did after it all collapsed. So when we talk about who got hurt in this case, I don't mean the 751 people who'd eat at those salad bars. I mean the believers too. People who gave up everything for a dream only to learn it had been hijacked by someone willing to poison a town in their name. They have to carry that, and a small number of them did cross the line and take part. We'll get into who knew what when, because by the end, sorting the victims from the accomplices is one of the hardest parts of this whole story. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode. To enhance your listening experience, join Crime House Plus and get all three parts of each week's America's Most Infamous Crime Stories dropped at once every Monday and ad-free. You also get the rest of the Crime House lineup ad-free and early and exclusive bonus episodes. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you listen on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of the America's Most Infamous Crime show page. Come back tomorrow for the final episode on the Rajneesh movement. Hi everyone, it's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.